something really intelligent, and if I do, I want to be sure to capture it, because I'm still waiting. So, has everybody got one of my advertisers? Good, okay. It has all sorts of websites on it. Okay, and I'll leave them here in case anybody comes later. And the other advertiser about transcendental meditation, which I'll be talking about, I'll leave this here too. So, first of all, I want to be sure you're aware of some webcasts or conferences. So on September 29th, there was a broadcast. Kamara Jones was one of the speakers. She's the recent past president of the American Public Health Association and a terrific speaker. The other speakers were excellent too, they're from UNC. Wisdom Powell moderated. And then coming on February 23rd, the 39th Annual Minority Health Conference, launched in 1977. And the recordings from last year, several sessions, are at the next at that link. So here's an outline of what I was planning to talk about. A little bit about sources of ideas, some perspectives, transcendental meditation, I think it's worth a look, and a question, must inequality necessarily be harmful? So sources for ideas, just a few. Back in the 70s, there used to be a student lounge in Rosenau, and there was a table outside, and faculty would leave their old journals on it. So I would, in those days, people picked up journals, and I would, you know, they weren't all online, they weren't online at all. So there was no online. So I picked up a copy of Science, and I said, well, this is interesting. So I started reading as people would toss Science, I would read it, and then I said, you know, I guess I should join the AAAS, American Association for the Advancement of Science, and read it. And I've been doing it since the 70s. I don't read it all. I don't understand probably 90%. But even that 10% that I do understand has been really valuable over the years. And here are four examples of recent articles from the last few weeks, a couple months. One is the one that I circulated in advance to Parna. So one in three Chinese children grows up in a rural area without enough parental stimulation, intellectual stimulation for intellectual development. So there are, 1.3 billion people in China, so we're talking 400 million children whose intellectual development is seriously stunted. This is a huge deal, and there's a project that some man is doing, or a group, to try to change this. Just an example of the huge things that are out there that we're not generally aware of, and this came out in one of the news articles in Science. The next one was on socio-technical transitions to decarbonization, talking about in Germany how getting to an economy without as much carbon is partly a technological issue, but there are enormous political, economic, and social dimensions to that, and we need to think about all of these things together because they reinforce each other, interfere with each other. So that's an example of that. Then there was an article I read this morning, I haven't even finished it yet, about training entrepreneurs, training small business people to be more, to take more initiative and be more effective as entrepreneurs, and this seems to be more effective based on a randomized trial compared to traditional business education for small business people in Africa. And right after, it was an article about a study that showed that when infants see an adult persisting, they are more likely to persist. So we're very malleable, and life is very complex. So something else I invite you to do is to browse my virtual library. So for the last 4 years, I've taught a course with Bill Jenkins, who's now retired, and we won't be teaching the course. For that purpose, I created a virtual library. The course materials are at this website, links up at the top. And if you click that virtual library link, these are things that I invited people to browse for the class. There's a section on big challenges for public health. You can imagine what a lot of them are. I don't have a complete list. Some case examples: choice, behavior, decision making, perception, mental processes, which affect individual behavior, but also decision making for groups and organizations. Much of public health, many of the problems in public health arise because the decision making by people who are in positions of influence and power are harmful to public health. And so understanding that decision making is, I think, of great value and potential for public health. Then I have applied sciences, more basic sciences, organizations, things about individuals, and then a section on transcendental meditation, which I'll talk about later. And I just had a couple of boxed examples of things that are in the library. But it's huge. You can't read it all, but you might want to browse it. There are a lot of videos. There are NPR programs, etc. So now I want to give you some perspectives that I'm in my eighth decade, I realized, and I've been at the School of Public Health. I first came here in 1972 as a master's student in health education. I actually came a little before then. And so this is kind of where I am now. So there was a section here on health disparities, which is what I drew this from, these slides from, many of them. And so health disparities, the concept was getting a lot of traction in the last century, and there was a goal to eliminate health disparities in the U.S. health objectives for the nation. It hasn't happened, in case you haven't noticed. But there's been a lot of research, and this is just some examples of reports by the National Academy Press. But what gets left out of the discussion typically is the countervailing forces. So you have these public health types who are working to eliminate health disparities, but you also have a war on drugs, a war on crime, what Bob Fullalove in last year's Minority Health Conference called our carceral society. You have private for-profit prisons, as if the regular ones weren't enough. Well, they're not enough, so we have private ones. You have technology and automation, which is transforming life on a practically a daily basis. Globalization with outsourcing of jobs, immigration of low-skilled workers, and other changes. You have the genomics and biotechnology developments, escalation in education requirements, and then dot, dot, dot. Life is complex. There are all these things going on. Social determinants of health is a major area that's getting attention. I just put down a smattering of examples of some of the authors and some of the things that they've written about, but it's a hugely complex. It says social, but it's also economic, it's also political. It's also, they typically don't write about them, but in some cases they do, because early life experiences change the brain, and then that affects the rest of the life. So I gave a talk here in the school about a little bit more than a year ago that I called Epidemiology, Equity, Economics, Evolution, and Enlightenment, to try to get a comprehensive perspective on what are the factors that underlie health equity. So epidemiology, which is essential for understanding and improving the health of all people. Equity, which related to social justice, which reflects the distribution of power. Economics, because economic resources are fundamental to public health. They're fundamental to all of life. Every process requires access to resources. Every metabolic process, every organizational process. It's true in biology, it's true in our daily work. If you can't get money for your project, you can't do much of a project. Departments need money, et cetera, et cetera. So economics and the way resources are distributed is a very important area to understand. But evolution is also fundamental, because what we are really expressions of biology. If you think back, 3 billion years to the beginning of life? A lot's been going on during that period of time. We see a tiny fraction of an instant in that trajectory. So one of the key messages of epidemiology is that what exists has survived from the past. If it didn't survive, may have existed millions of years ago, but if it didn't survive in some form of inheritance, it's gone. So we are survivors. And some of you may have heard of the concept of selective survival, which in epidemiology is a way of describing a certain potential for bias in doing studies. You have a population, and the people in it who are alive now or in the situation you're looking at have survived from whatever they were before. Not all of them survived, so you have a selective survival. And evolution is a selective survival process. Many things that existed before don't remain today. The only ones today that will endure, the ones today that endure are the ones that will affect the future going long term. So understanding evolution, and that evolving through time is an emergent behavior. In other words, we have billions of people, and within each of our bodies are billions of neurons and other cells, and they're all acting as individuals.
just as we act as individuals. We think about others, we adjust our behavior in relation to others, but we're still, you know, I need to eat, I'm hungry, gotta get some food, I gotta get to this place on time, I'm being evaluated on this, I better be ready for that, I've got my partner to think about. And so we're all thinking as individuals, and it's out of our individual interactions that society manifests. So it's what scientists call an emergent phenomenon that can be very hard to predict. We may think we can predict. We know we can't. At least we can't much of the time. So greater understanding of emergent phenomena would be useful. And enlightenment I use to mean a broader and deeper understanding of our nature and our environment. And I think that may help humanity to manage our collective lives better, which I think is necessary for advancing public health in the present and in the future. We will always be individuals and acting as individuals, but to do it in a way where our awareness is broad enough for us to think about the future, not be short-sighted, overly short-sighted. You need to think about the present because it makes a lot of difference, but to do so without thinking about the future also leads to less valuable behavior. But also to think about other people and far away effects, indirect effects. Every action has multiple effects, some of which help some people and may harm others, which some of those effects are near term, some are later. And so this great complexity, our broader awareness will enable us to do a better job of navigating it. So complexity is the first point in my list of things here. We are systems within systems. Life is an emergent phenomena, and there's a website where you can read about emergent phenomena. We have evolved to cope with this complexity. We think it's complex for us. Imagine what it was like for those first organisms, single cellular organisms, or you know, a few cells at a time, or a little plant or whatever. They had to cope with this complexity too. They didn't have to worry about computers and the internet, but they still had to cope with a lot of complexity. And how have animals and humans evolved to deal with this complexity? Well, we have reasoning, but we use simplified representations. You see people here, but actually your eyes are taking in light sensations that aren't at all necessarily people. There are all these light sensations and then there's sound sensations. Your brain is forming those images and recognizing those images. And you have to learn to do that, and in some circumstances the learning doesn't work so well. So you do this partly by ignoring a lot of the stimuli. So all these radio waves that are coursing through here, some parts of our body are probably are receiving them, but they're ignoring them because they're not helpful. Just as there are flashes of light and so on that your brain is trained to, you know, not useful, don't think about it. So there's a simplification, and we simplify at the intellectual level as well. So we develop proverbs and maxims. We talk about significant results and evidence-based as if that is somehow going to guide us to making correct decisions. And that reductionism has been extremely effective in helping us to navigate the challenges of living and interacting. And it's enabled our species to flourish in some respects. I mean, we have certainly been fruitful and multiplied. 7 billion humans when you had, you know, like a few million, not too many hundreds of years ago. So it's been extremely effective for our flourishing in terms of our reproduction and our technology and the quality of life many of us experience. But at the same time, we appear to be destroying our environment, which is a very short-sighted thing to do in the long term. So when you're simplifying and being selective, there's always the risk of oversimplifying. You know that simplifications, we have models, and they're evaluated and declared to be useful, effective, and accurate based on what we regard as important, but of course through inevitably incomplete criteria. So for obvious practical reasons, we want to have measurable objectives. If we can't measure them, how can we apply them? But measurable doesn't necessarily mean they're the most important. It's just what we can measure. It's like the drunk looking under the lamppost. Why are you looking under the lamppost? For your wallet? Well, that's where the light is. We also use relatively near-term criteria because we can't afford to wait too long for the answers. And they can't be too subtle, we won't notice them. And they have to be relevant in terms of our understanding of what's relevant. So, for example, if we have a teaching innovation, and we find out that it improves student performance on examinations, we'll say, hey, this is effective, and you can publish that in Science. If it increases dementia rates 3 decades later, will we notice that? Is it effective if that's the case? It's a bad deal, but when will we notice that? Probably we'll never even think to look. So it's really impossible. I think important questions, it's impossible to know the right answer. So science is also a system within systems. Scientific research is a broad conversation in which different investigator communities explore, present, critique, debate, persuade, or they don't persuade others until some kind of consensus is reached. And that's possibly going to be upset when a new discovery comes along. I mean, this is how else could science proceed? It's people, right? And people don't have authority except what they're given by other people. So the process of science involves persuading peers and gatekeepers that you have an idea worth funding, an idea worth pursuing and being funded, that you have something worth being published. So there need to be editors and reviewers who say, yes, this is worthwhile. And it has to be regarded as accurate. You're trying to persuade people it's accurate. And the way you do that is there aren't any serious criticisms that people raise. How else could the search for truth work? We like to think that science brings us to the truth. But science is just a social activity. And the judgment of our peers is what says, yes, this is correct. This is science. You get consensus conferences where they try to work out the differences or work through a body of knowledge. So there are no authorities except humans, at least if some people think God is the ultimate authority, but the word of God typically comes through humans. So I don't know any other way it could work.
Dr. Sherman.
Yeah, you can call me Vic, by the way.
Okay, I apologize, several of us have a class.
Okay.
So I didn't want to disrupt when we're leaving.
Okay.
We really appreciate you coming and thank you so much for being here.
Okay, when is the class?
1:30, so we're rushing down now.
Wasn't I told it was 12 to 1?
Oh, no, so, we have a separate class.
Mm-hmm.
Oh.
So a few people, I believe, have to leave.
Okay, so obviously that's fine. I'm recording it if you decide that you want to hear the rest of it.
Great,
so,
thank you.
And I appreciate your coming even when you didn't have the time. And thank you for letting me know that it wasn't something I said.
Yeah.
Oh my goodness, what did I say? Sure. Yeah, seats now. Good. So people won't have to stand.
It's a seat for those that are on the floor. It's free to take a chair.
Whoops.
Sorry.
No, it's okay. There's another seat there. So right choices, which is what we all strive for, are elusive. And I've mentioned this, I guess, already. Most actions have multiple effects. Some are good, some are bad, distant, near term. So the idea of one size fits all never completely applies. So actions affect some people and some groups in one way and others in another way. And so there's always going to be differences of opinion about what's best. I have an example here. Back in the 90s, it was suggested that the price on gasoline should be raised. There should be a tax on gasoline prices, which, as someone who had economics training, seemed to me to be a great idea. So there's something called external diseconomies, means that you pay for something, but there may be costs to society that aren't included in that. So the pollution, the noise, the climate change and all that arises when we drive cars are external diseconomies, and they're not captured in any of the things we're paying. So when we buy gasoline at the price we pay, it's not really reflecting the true cost of society. It would be better if it cost more. But once they floated that idea, it was totally rejected by the American public and the politicians. So there must always be trade-offs, and typically we don't know the full accounting, and they're not on an abstract scale that they're in relation to people's interests. So when you try to take away tenure, you can be sure that I'm going to say no, at least until I'm on Facebook. I mean, now that I'm on Facebook, I'm not on tenure anymore, but when I was, and say, no, that's, and I have all these good reasons why tenure is important. Other people will say, tenure keeps lazy people on, you know, they're not productive and we can't get rid of them and all that. So there is no answer to most important questions. No right answer. But it doesn't matter because people see things their own way anyway. So even if there were a right answer, how would we know? How could we persuade people? There's no way to recognize right answers, and people wouldn't believe them unless they thought the results were visibly favorable to their interests. Now, there are life is complex, there are exceptions. There are people who can somehow or other see things that aren't in their interest and still say these are right. And it does happen. But on the whole, it's not as common. So the policies that actually emerge and are implemented will be the outcome of a competition and cooperation among the various agents. Competition and cooperation are fundamental to every area of life. Your own biology is based on competition and cooperation. You've got receptors on your cell membranes, and the molecules are competing to access those receptors, and they're cooperating. The receptor cooperates with the neurotransmitter or whatever hormone or whatever it is that's binding. So cooperation and competition are fundamental. We are not as rational or evidence-based as we think. So humans, for the most part, advocate and pursue what we regard, and that includes unconscious influences, as in our interests. And I'm using real broad definitions here. And that pursuit affects our very perceptions. So it's partly by a question of what we pay attention to. If I'm hungry, I pay attention to things about food. And it also affects our judgment and what we devote our energies to. So we are biological creatures, whether we like to think of ourselves that way or not. So if society is emergent behavior, we need better agents. If you want a better result, I don't think that there's an alternative, at least a complete alternative, to having better agents, better people. Because you can say, I can design a better system, and indeed you can. But you need the people to get the system into place. So if you don't like capitalism, you think capitalism's the problem, we need a better system, and you come up with one, you still need to get the people to accept this new system. And any system will work better or worse according to how the people are. If people are irritable, disgruntled, they don't read well, they're impulsive, they don't think clearly, then your system will not work as well as it will if they are more content, well-rested, they think clearly, they can read well, they can communicate well, any system will work better. So I think we need to get better agents. So one question I raised along the way is, does an emphasis on disparities versus equality rather than on overall public health generate friction and resistance? I don't know, that'd be interesting to talk about. I just threw that out when I was putting these things together a month ago or so, and I have an open mind about it. So when we observe society through the media and through daily interactions, we see random examples. I'm just picking some random examples of behavior in public health. We see cooperativeness, helpfulness, and we see corruption and anger. And those clearly have different implications for public health. We see rationality and irrationality. Religion, very complex area, very powerful force that sometimes facilitates health, sometimes not. We had the situation of Houston, the people volunteering in Houston, even at some considerable difficulty, to help people who had been really harmed. We have the question that arose about flood insurance. Is flood insurance good? Should we have more flood insurance? Should we require people to have flood insurance? Should we let people build in flood areas so that they can have, and then they're saved by flood insurance? These are very complex issues to which there are no real answers. But I think better people will operate better. Then there was the Muncie, Indiana report on opioid use. So that came across me. Okay, so when I was putting this presentation together, the health disparities one, an article came out about grumpiness and lack of sleep. So there's the quote, when people don't get enough sleep, their moods are poorer, we're grumpier, our moods are poorer. Lack of sleep hurts the relationship. What they did was a randomized trial in which they took couples and they deprived one or both or neither of sleep. They put them in a laboratory, made sure they didn't sleep more than they were supposed to, and then they put them in situations of potential conflict. And what they found was that cytokine production, so that's a biological molecule that they were using as an indicator of arousal, was increased after marital conflict when they didn't get enough sleep, if one of the partners didn't get enough sleep. When the people who slept less behaved more negatively and less positively, but only when their partner had also slept less. So if one of you gets enough sleep, it can dampen the interaction in ways that are more helpful. So one's own and one's partner's use of emotion regulation strategies during the conflict also buffered the short sleep. So there are things you can do if you're not getting enough sleep to avoid exacerbating conflicts, but for those who don't use those, conflict is increased and your biological response to it is increased, which can also lead to harm to your health. So there are the references there. So I want to say a few things about transcendental meditation, which I think is worth a look for public health. I learned TM in 1972 when I was a master's student, my first semester in the master's program in health education, it was called then, health behavior now. My brother had learned and he said, Vic, you should learn this, it's good. So I decided to learn partly because it seemed to be helping him, and I thought, well, if I learn and practice it, that'll help him stay with it, and since it seems to be helping him, that would be useful. It probably would be good for me, certainly unlikely to be bad, and I was learning about stress in my epidemiology course, and I knew so anyway. So over the years, I've watched TM disseminate, I've watched the research accumulate, and I think TM has fantastic potential for public health, partly in relation to this discontent thing. If people are content, they're less likely to be vulnerable to responding to some of the things that cause trouble. So this is I don't know, do we have 3 minutes to listen to it? Maybe I'll try. Except I probably didn't do the volume. Is somebody near, can you turn the volume up there? There's the volume knob under the light. Well, looks like we're not getting it. This is up, that's up.
I think the computer's on mute. Oh. The bottom right.
Thank you. Well, okay. Well, anyway, listen to it. It's short. What she says essentially is that I thought that when I learned TM, that stress would just go away. No more stress. But that actually hasn't been the case. But what I do find is it doesn't bother me the way it used to. I don't react the same way. And so, let's get out of here. I don't react the way I used to, and so it's not as much of a problem. And that is, I think, a fairly typical experience. She's a grad student, by the way. Here are some quotes. TM has been used in a school in Fairfield, Iowa, the Maharishi School. Maharishi Mahesh Yogi was the man who brought transcendental meditation outside of India. So you can say the students have the longest attention span of any I've seen in 30 years of teaching and education. So some very positive experiences. And this is a private school. Probably the educational level of the parents and the income levels are higher than typical. But it's not only in places like that. So this is San Francisco, several public schools that the Surgeon General, Vivek Murthy, former Surgeon General, visited a couple of years ago. And you can see him sitting on the stage there in a middle school classroom. So these were schools which had serious problems in terms of fighting and attendance and all sorts of other things that we are concerned about, and teacher turnover. And they brought TM in, all the students, all the teachers, all the staff, and it transformed the schools. The whole environment became much more supportive of education. Teacher turnover went way down, fighting went way down, the school's academic performance went up, and the Surgeon General talked about it in a TED-Med presentation, and he put up these posts on his Facebook page, which is where I got this. It's not only in the United States that these are going on. This is in, Mozambique. This is an elementary school in Mozambique where the kids were all learning TM. This was back in the 90s. This is in a rural area in the mountains in Mexico, Oaxaca, where children are learning. Here's another picture from Oaxaca, another. So these pictures came from Antonio Gonzalez, who's the man in the bottom right of this photo, who was the national TM director for Portugal. And he was recruited to go to Mozambique to teach not only the students, but the military. I'll say something about that soon. He was also later recruited to go to Mexico to teach in these rural schools. He's now back in Portugal. So these are just some images, and there are links behind them if you want to click them. The one in the top left is South Africa. The one in the top right is Portugal, where this man I've just showed you was teaching, or is teaching TM. I have Uganda, Thailand in the bottom left. In the middle on the right is Brazil, and Jamaica over here. And then you can see Arizona. And this is Maharishi Mahesh Yogi giving a talk, answering a question, rather, back in the 70s. So there's something that came out in the 70s called the Maharishi effect. If you get enough people practicing TM in an area, it seems to reduce conflict in the society, crime rates, accidents, and fighting. So this is pretty wild stuff. And it's not presumably the people who were doing the fighting who were learning TM, because they sometimes even bring in people to practice TM in that area. But it's something that seems to maybe more fundamental in our existence. And there's a lot that we don't understand. So I'm not saying no, I'm not saying yes. But in any case, there have been over 50 studies now that have been published where these effects have been reported in the United States and elsewhere in the world. In Mozambique, President Joaquim Chissano, who's the second man from the left, credits TM with ending the civil war in that country. There was a terrible civil war going on at the end of the 1980s, beginning of the 1990s. And Joaquim Chissano learned, I forget who it was who encouraged him to learn, and along with his family. Then he had his cabinet learn, and then they had most of the military learn, and that's where Antonio Gonzalez, the man on the far right, was one of the TM teachers who was teaching the military. So they taught the military, and peace broke out. And Joaquim Chissano, who recently received an award that's been called the African Nobel, credits TM with being an important part of that. Here are just some of the papers about the Maharishi effect. So you can see that they're in real journals and worth taking a look at. There are a number of militaries which are trying to develop what is being referred to as an invincible military. So Nepal, Ukraine, and several in Latin America. And if you click those links, you can see them. I have photos on the left from the different militaries. You know, a lot of this doesn't fit with the conventional science that we understand now. But as this book illustrates the structure of scientific revolutions, science goes through revolutions in understanding where a prevailing paradigm doesn't really account for the observations, and eventually the paradigm can be overthrown. So we may be seeing a new paradigm at some point that will explain this. So my last few minutes on, so must inequality necessarily be harmful? Remember, I was teaching a course, that was that first one of those early slides, on social justice and equality. Because equality is something that we all believe in. And yet, if you really go and analyze it, I'm not sure equality is necessarily viable, necessarily desirable. A big question is, what happens with the inequality? So if we're all equal, nobody has a whole lot of money, right? We all, I mean, depends. All equal, you mean the whole world? 7 billion people, take all the wealth of the world and divide it up. Who's going to be donating to the art museums and the universities and that sort of stuff? It's a very different animal. But what do people do when they have a lot of money? Do they use it to help the world? Do they use it to share the benefits of their wisdom so that there are actually multiple sources of good, not only concentrated in the government? Or did they use it for self-aggrandizement, to dissemble, to harm, to say junk science doesn't exist? That, to me, is the big question. So a number of years ago, there was a dinner that was organized by Warren Buffett and Bill Gates and others, where they got together a group of billionaires who agreed to give half of their wealth away for social causes. So here's the item from the Daily Telegraph in UK. 40 billionaires worth a combined $230 billion signed a giving pledge to donate at least 50% of their wealth to good causes. Now, you can donate and you can harm, and you can donate and you can distort, but this is still a step ahead, or step forward, from giving, from essentially keeping self-aggrandizement, only your family, etc. So there was a dinner that was envisaged by Warren Buffett, organized by Bill and Melinda Gates, hosted by David Rockefeller in New York, and this is an article which talks about it a bit. So I'm going to stop here and invite your questions and comments. But do visit my virtual library and my other website if you go there, if you browse around. I've got recorded interviews with past chairs and faculty and alumni from the Department of Epidemiology, but some other departments too. Like the first woman and the first African-American to sing with the UNC Men's Glee Club at the New York World's Fair in 1964. Bernice Otedeko was a graduate of health education, 1966. So anyway, I've got some good things. But thank you very much. Certainly enjoyed it. If you want me to turn off the recorder during your questions or comments, just say so and I will do that.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
I just have a question with the like the last point that you made. Is it sort of like the like trickle down theory? Is that like what it's
not to me. I mean, that's not the way I'm meaning
it. Not the dinner, but yeah.
And that's not, I don't think, what they mean. Trickle-down says people get a lot of wealth, they will spend their money. When they spend their money, that creates jobs and production, and that way other people earn money and so on. And there's certainly some truth to that. But you can trickle down in a big way, or you can trickle down in a little way. Trickle is small, obviously. What I mean is, so everything needs resources. All the good causes we want, all the interventions we think would be helpful need resources. Where will those resources come from? They can come from the government, if the government has money, and if you can persuade the government to spend the money that way, and if the government can do it in a way that's helpful. Government doesn't always make things better. Government projects, one problem is the government is supposed to serve everybody. It's really serving the contending forces that are competing for the government. If all the powers in the government, that competition to control government is intensified even more. So there are some negatives to, you know, the big government people. I'm a liberal, so I'm a so-called big government, but I can see the bigger the government, the bigger a prize it is, and then you get yet more competition for it. Look at the billions and billions of dollars that we use, some might say waste, competing over government. That could go for productive purposes instead of negative advertising, which is harming the society and using up resources. It's employing people, but not in a way we want to see them employed. So if we had people with money giving for good causes, then that's a much better way, I think, to help get the resources for things than the things that you care about and you want to see. You're willing to donate to those. Maybe I don't care about them. I'm not donating to those, but I don't need to because you've got enough money to give this organization something that would enable it to work. So that's kind of what I meant, rather than trickle down. It's a good question, though. Yes?
Do you happen to know off the top of your head how the studies of TM were structured to sort of find the association between TM and TM practice and then those indicators?
The social discontent and conflict. Mm-hmm. Well, there are a lot of studies, and so they were structured to different ways. Mm-hmm. I know one of the earliest studies published, I think it was in 1975, had 10 towns, really. Chapel Hill was one, where 1% of the population had learned TM, and 10 control towns, which were matched. So they were supposed to be similar. The match for Chapel Hill was Rocky Mount. You can decide whether you think that's sufficiently similar. And then they compared the crime statistics, you know, the published crime statistics for those two. This is, I mean, of course, this is very difficult kind of research to do in a rigorous or unimpeachable fashion. There was a study in Washington, which was a before-after, where they used the public statistics on crime and some other variables, and they took into account seasonal adjustments and all that. When they announced in advance, we're going to bring several thousand people to these facilities in Washington, D.C., and they're all going to practice TM, and then they're going to go, and we're going to see what happens during that. And there seemed to be this decrease in crime associated with the rise in the number of people, and then it went up later. These are very hard studies to have real full confidence in. On the other hand, the amount of money that goes into these studies is pretty small. And almost all of the studies are done by people who are advocates for TM or enthusiasts. And everybody wants to see studies by people who are not involved with TM. So, you know, the drug companies do studies, and their drugs always look better in their studies than the other studies. Some people are rightly question that, or skeptical, or whatever. And the same is true with studies of TM. Until we get people in public health or in other areas who are doing studies on TM and are not themselves very invested in it, you can't get that full scientific conversation.
What do you think, like, what type of paradigm shift, then, do you think needs to happen for that for that acceptance of people who might not be advocates for it?
Oh, I think it's happening. I mean, I'm not an advocate of mindfulness, and I know very little about it, but mindfulness now is everywhere, it seems. 20 years ago, who heard of it? I mean, certainly back in the 70s, nobody was talking about mindfulness. So there are changes. I think meditation in general is more open to that now. And I know when I talk to people about TM, sometimes they say, well, I've been meditating, it's not TM, but I've been doing this meditation, it's been very helpful to me. So I think there is a gradual opening up of people's receptivity to these other methods. The American Heart Association came out with a statement recently about TM being one of the more valuable methods. The one they came out with several years ago said that of the various non-pharmacological methods, this is the only one, actually, for which there's sufficient evidence to give it a class, and I can't remember their ABC structure. It wasn't the top, but it was a fairly high rating. And then recently, I think they had a statement about meditation more, about other kinds as well. So I think it is happening. I don't think it's a fundamental paradigm shift, because we already know about stress, and so things that relieve stress will be helpful.
Thank you.
That's a good question. Yes.
I guess I'm still a little skeptical of the argument that we should trust very wealthy people to be giving money to good things.
Did I say trust? No, seriously, did I say trust?
No, absolutely not, of course. But I guess I wonder what you would say about the argument that there's sort of this paternalism that comes with that you have, you know, this small number of people, 1% of the world now owns over 50% of the wealth in the world, and letting them make those decisions about, you know, they're not necessarily experts in these world.
Did I say letting them? How are you going to stop them? I mean, first of all, you didn't give them that money. They got it. Okay?
Yeah.
They're not going to give it back to you in any way that I know of.
Mm-hmm.
And you say, trusting them, you don't have the choice. They've got it, they do what they want. I'm just saying that if they have broader awareness, the results will be better than if they have narrow awareness. If they spend the money to say, climate change doesn't exist, these scientists are ridiculous, don't believe anything you read, et cetera, et cetera, that will not be as good as if they say, yes, science is important, we're gonna help to fund good science, and we're going to help to change things for the better, for humanity. I mean, like, look what Bill and Melinda Gates are doing. They're very wealthy, and they're doing as much as WHO in many respects. I mean, they're making a tremendous difference. Is everything they're doing the best thing to do? I don't know. I'm not suggesting that it would be. Should we trust them to do it? Well, do you want to stop them? I mean, that's the choice. It's not as if we're saying, should we have a society where people are wealthy and they can give away money? It exists. And if you want to try to have a revolution, you could try to do one. But revolutions don't always work out so well, though. Historically, a revolution means the people who have the power, or who can get power, then have it. And people who can get power are not necessarily the people you really want to have power. So I considered myself a revolutionary back in the 60s. Small stuff, you know, nothing serious, and certainly no firearms. I was at the London School of Economics in the 60s, and we had a student occupation. And the school didn't like one of the demonstrations. They put up these iron gates in the hallway so they could partition off the school. We thought this was outrageous. We were going to tear the gates down. We tore the gates down. They closed the school. And what I realized after that, I mean, they opened it up again, but what I realized after that was that once that happened, this semi-democratic student organization that had called for the gates to come down, it was totally gone because we couldn't meet anymore. Where was the power? Well, there was a sort of a Leninist group that had been working alongside. They had been organized. They knew each other. They had a lawyer lined up and stuff. So the power was shifting to them. They weren't necessarily democratic. They believed in what I think it was called democratic socialism or something, but it was, or no, it was not something. It was essentially, you know, there's an elite of people who are really highly conscious and they should have the power, the Politburo type thing. It's too long ago. But anyway, what I realize is when you get disorder and chaos like that, what comes out of it is not necessarily what you thought you were going to get. So I'm not an advocate of huge wealth disparities. I think that if people with huge amounts of wealth had broader awareness, they would share their wealth more, and they would help to ensure that it's used so that you don't have people who are so poor. What kind of a society lets so many of its children grow up without their basic necessities? And by basic necessities, I mean not only food and warmth and security and so on, but also intellectual stimulation, the kinds of things we talk about with early childhood development. These are the people who are going to, this is our future population. Why would we want a population that's stunted? In China, it's a third. It's not as bad as a third in the United States, but it's a substantial fraction. And in some groups, it's really substantial. Why? And this is something that we have all allowed to continue, even with the knowledge that it's not necessary. And it's not huge amounts of money. Barack Obama was saying every child should have early childhood development resources available. Well, why didn't it happen? Because of those contending forces, and in another sense of that, because of lack of awareness among people with power and money. And the kind of research that I think would be one of the most transformative would be, what is it that leads to the decision making or awareness? You know, if we could measure awareness, what leads to broader or narrow awareness, particularly in people who have money and power? Because they have a lot to do with what goes on. And if we could broaden their awareness, and sometimes it does get broadened. I mean, Bill Gates was not always a philanthropist. Something changed. And in epidemiology, we say, you know, we can do comparisons. We take people who are like this and people who are like this, we compare them, we look for the risk factors or the characteristics. We could say, here are wealthy people who are generous, here are wealthy people who are not generous. Here are wealthy people who do things that at least we regard as positive for society and public health, and here are people who are doing things that we regard as negative. What's the difference? Is it their upbringing? Is it their early life experiences? Is it genetic? Is it diet? Is it exposure to electromagnetic radiation? Is it the kinds of social interactions that I have? I mean, I'm just throwing things out. I don't know, but you know, we're complex organisms and everything affects everything. So, could be imprinting.
Well, thank you everyone for coming today. And thank you so much, Dr. Schoenbach. This is really interesting. Thanks so much.
Thank you all very much. Thank you all very much.